topic we will discuss in these brief few moments is becoming, unfortunately, more and more important. The issue that we have to raise needs to be raised, and increasingly so, with a larger population. More and more people will have to be made aware of the dangers of substance abuse. We have, in our time, seen a society that is increasingly permissive, that has allowed for individuals to do more and more in the way of self-destructive behavior. Eight states of the United States and the District of Columbia legally permit recreational use of marijuana. Now, the federal government at this time has not legalized it, but state level, it's being not only legalized, but it's almost being promoted, because after all, once it's legal, so then it's controlled somewhat, and then taxes are derived, and the government benefits, which incentivizes the government, and then ultimately the society, but all in the wrong direction. If in Washington, D.C., it's legal, so maybe that explains why so much right thinking cannot be found in Washington, D.C., because maybe they're just on the reefer a bit too much. It's a very dangerous step here in New York State, for example, where it's being decriminalized, if not legalized, so that no longer is it a criminal arrest, but only a citation. So we're creeping, or not even creeping, maybe even walking some places, running to full legalization of marijuana. So we'll have then a world in which alcohol is readily available, marijuana readily available, and there are differences, noted differences. A non-alcoholic who is otherwise a helpful person in his habits, he lives healthfully, has a drink or two, even if it affects him or her, the body metabolizes the alcohol quickly, and in a few hours you wouldn't find a trace of it in a blood or urine sample of it. But in the case of marijuana, a person who smokes a reefer will be caught in drug tests days, even weeks later. So clearly this is a great problem, and that there are effects is clear. If a person becomes physically tolerant of these drugs, whether it's alcohol and then marijuana, whatever it might be, the next step is the body craves and needs more. The craving is that there's a desire for it. The need is that the body doesn't respond to the lower amount. It needs greater amounts, more powerful drugs. And that's why these are the gateway drugs. Alcohol and the marijuana bring people to much more hard, more dangerous types of substances, because the body eventually becomes so used to the lesser and less powerful substances.
But not everybody becomes an alcoholic.
Not everybody who smokes marijuana, 100%. But because of the very, very prevalent addiction rates, we know that a substance such as marijuana, a substance such as alcohol, cannot simply be said to be quote-unquote safe, and let's move on.
Because you never know if you'll be.
And then there are people who are genetically predisposed to addiction more than other people. Obviously, there are people whose lifestyle and in their way of thinking and living are also going to be more likely to end up abusing substances, and that's the subject that we will, in Yirtzeh Hashem, dwell upon for a few minutes. The danger of someone who is taking in all of these kinds of drugs, and the danger, for instance, of marijuana is something called amotivational syndrome. People who have taking in a certain measure of marijuana, even if they're not addicted, because it's not an addictive kind of drug, but people who have taken in and continue to smoke pot have less drive for life, for education, for whatever achievements that all of us wish to have and should have drives for. All of these are reduced by use of marijuana. So we have to recognize that we have a problem and that we're living in a society that's increasingly permissive and that that's not a good thing. We have people, Davening and Schultz, where fortunately there's awareness of the problem, so much so that the response has been no alcohol in shul whatsoever. I'm not advocating or not advocating that approach, but if a shul has to bar, that's a bad pun, if a shul has to bar alcohol at a kiddush, no one may have alcohol at a kiddush, no matter how extravagant and beautiful you are celebrating your simcha, you may not have alcohol at a kiddush. If that's the extent to which we have to go in order to address this kind of a problem, we have a problem. If students are in their gap year, I don't like to call it that, but if they're trying to gain by being in Eretz Yisrael for a year or two after high school and are arrested for public drunkenness in Eretz Yisrael, and parents and grandparents hear about this and have to clamor to A, cover it up, B, obviously make sure that the child eventually gets onto a better path. This is how our children are in part spending some time in Eretz Yisrael after high school. We have a problem. If in shuls where they do or do not allow alcohol at a kiddush, we have kiddush clubs that meet after davening. That's better after all. We're not missing any part of davening, God forbid. But after davening, we go to each other's homes and spend time drinking each week at one or two homes and circulating between them and celebrating the Shabbos for its time to drink instead of for its time to learn and daven and grow spiritually and spend time with family. So time is spent with friends instead of with family. By the time the family gets together for lunch at 2 o'clock, father comes home soused. Maybe he'll wash him, go into his bed to sleep it off. And the children are watching all of this. And they're seeing what this means to their father. This is his way of life. And children are learning this. This is chinuch havani. If that can happen, and it's not happening in one or two homes, or in one or two communities, or shuls, if that's what's happening, we have a problem. And yet, the common response often is denial. Absolute denial. People don't want to hear about it. People don't want to talk about it. Just like the people who are themselves abusing substances are most often in denial. The single greatest challenge to addressing what we're discussing is denial. And we have to know why denial plays such a huge role in the lives of people who really should know better and who should be able to look at themselves and say, I don't think this is what I should be doing. And they won't and they can't. That's how powerful denial really is. You know, the Jewish people conquered Jericho, and Yehoshua ben Nun placed a curse on anyone who would dare rebuild the city of Jericho. We read in Melachim Aleph how Chiel Beisraeli took upon himself to rebuild the city of Jericho. And the pasuk says that he began to build the city, and as he laid the foundations, his eldest son passed away. The curse began to be fulfilled. And he kept on building. And his children died. And as he put up the gates on the door entrance to the city, the Sha'arei Ha'ir as he installed the gates. That's considered the point where you have completed and secured the city. As he erects the gates to the city of Yericho, his youngest son dies. So he just continues, oblivious to the process, as if there was never any problem, no curse, nothing's happening. Denial. Because that's unfortunately what our self-destructive personality is capable of. And increasingly, professionals in the field of detox say to us that there is a certain self-destructive aspect to the human psyche, and it can come out in more or less, in greater or lesser dimensions, in anyone. And certainly in someone who starts to abuse substances, the self-destructive leaning or proclivity can become profound. And the way to make sure that they stay stuck right where they are, and don't have to do and won't do the hard work of getting out of the rut that they're in, is denial. Denial, therefore, is really, in a sense, at the root of what it is that causes people to continue to do the kind of behavior we're discussing and not seek help and not want to make a change in their lives. There's denial, one, of the danger. Two, there's denial of it being morally or Jewishly incorrect, that as a human being they're not fulfilling themselves. There's denial that they're not really, quote unquote, behaving in a proper, in a meaningful, what used to call a bakavidic way. Denial. Those are the two major areas of denial. Denial that it's dangerous. I'm only drinking a little bit. I'm only drinking one day. It's only for a few hours. Denial that it's wrong and that it's causing a lack of purposefulness in that person's life. Why is this denial possible? Why is it that someone who has promised himself or herself they're going to be good, they're going to live a purposeful life, they're going to have good friendships, a good marriage, raise a proper mishpacha, Shabbos is going to be beautiful, beautiful Shabbos, my Shabbos table will be a glorious time. Why is it that they can't look deeply enough into themselves and see this is not the Shabbos that I promised myself and my wife we would share? This is not the Shabbos that I want to create for my family. And they can't see it.
How did they feel when they do this?
I would ask if you could just if we did questions, we'll take questions. So the question is, therefore, how can they not see this? And why is this dimension of denial so powerful as to preclude readily addressing the problem that he or she's clearly seeing in their own lives? The answer is a bit deep, but not too difficult to comprehend. The reality of a person's own emptiness, the reality of how difficult he or she is finding it to have meaningful life and true happiness, that reality is so sad and so disconcerting that the person facing his or her own inner unhappiness and emptiness is so threatened by that unhappiness and so threatened by that emptiness that the only way to avoid the painfully and difficult sense of emptiness and of just not being important and not accomplishing and of not being great and happy and growing and thriving, the only way to avoid all of the pain for what's absent is to deny it. And because nature abhors a vacuum, and the easiest way to remain artificially happy and in denial of all the pain of that emptiness that's inside of us, once we try something that makes us, quote, end quote, feel good, so we continue to use something that will help us feel good. So if you take something that helps you avoid sensing and experiencing the emptiness that's so painful inside, so then you will successfully continue to deny all of that which is hurting you so much. You won't feel so much pain. And so that is why the typical alcoholic is in denial. And those who even begin to use alcohol, who are not yet addicted, suffer from a syndrome of denial. Because the real problem lies within, and just simply is not being addressed. And needs to be. Because unless and until the problem is addressed, even if the person is fortunate enough to somehow make his or her way to detox and full recovery, the problem is still there. All of the experts in the field know and understand that there has to be more than just a detox process. There has to be a rebuilding of the person. You can't just take away the poison. There has to be the, I don't want to say even substitution, because it's been the other way. Instead of having positive life, a fulfilling life, there's been a substitution of the substance. But removal of the substance is a start, and now you have to build the mensch, the whole person. We recently lost this fellow, Anthony Bourdain, executive chef and media star. Happened to have been a Jewish person. His mother was a Jewish woman. And he was infamously, by his own admission, a severe addict during his 20s and early 30s. Every decision they made in the kitchen, everything, was made on Quaaludes and LSD and cocaine and endless. Day after day, week after week, year after year. And finally, he pulled himself out of that and was clean. But again, wrote that there was still this, he called it a genie, inside of him. And he couldn't get it out. And he said, I'm denying myself so much that had made me so happy. Now I'm denying it, I'm not having it, I'm not partaking of any of it. I should be feeling so good. But to his work. And he wasn't feeling so good. Because unless there's something that is good, truly good, that fills a person's life, that which drove a person to sense that I've got to get something to make me feel good, whatever is missing in life, whatever is wrong, whatever is challenging, will still be there after the person achieves recovery. We have a responsibility, each of us as a human being, to build ourselves up and make of ourselves as noble and as worthy a human being as we can. To be partners with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, literally partners with the Ribono Shel Olam, in creating of ourselves an upstanding human being, a Tzelem Elokim, an image of God. You know, yesterday we read about this period of time in which Jewish people were complaining and murmuring against God and against Moshe Rabbeinu. And their punishment was snakes, poisonous snakes that bit the Jewish people Eileinu. And the solution, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Moshe, create a snake, put it up on a pole, and let everyone look at the snake. Gaze intently. The hibit means to look intently at the snake. Bahoy. And then the person who was bitten, then you will live. Why a snake? Jewish person look at a snake, and that will give, grant him or her life. The very snake whose venom is coursing through his veins or her veins, about to take life away. That's where to look.
It's like a vaccine.
The Malbim says a fascinating thing. The Gemara tells us that a human being after 120 body years in eternity, and after a few years, the skeletal spine turns into a snake, the Gemara says. What does that mean? It doesn't happen for everyone. The Gemara says it happens to those who didn't say modim and bend their back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in thanks for all that God has given them. That person's spine turns into a snake. So the Malbim says, the snake it turns into is the snake within every human being. Every human being has that aspect. That Nachash HaKadmoni, original snake, brought something into Chava, insinuated itself into the existence of man, into the nature of man. So that within every one of us, there's mother and there's father and there's this, the Nachash. There's Adam and Chava and the Nachash. And the charge for a Jewish person is to recognize this and say, I have to look at my Nachash. I have to face my Nachash. I have to look at the Nachash within and I have to say, out, out. Looking at the Nachash in the Midbar, looking up at the Nachash and then achieving salvation and living, meant to look inside and say, am I a pleasure seeker? What is it that drives me every day? What am I looking to or for so that I could have, quote, end quote, happiness? Because if a person is satisfying this Nachash, and if that's the purpose of life, if that's why a person is living, whether he or she realizes it or not, then they're basically feeding this huge Nachash. Instead of creating every other worthy part of their being, instead of developing their minds and souls, such a person is just feeding this Nachash. And after 120 and they're interned, the Gemara is saying, what's left? What have you got? What have you made of yourself? A big Nachash. And that's the meaning of what the Gemara means, where the Gemara says, that person's spine, your skeletal spine, will turn into a snake. So that all of us are facing this challenge. That there should not be this huge vacuum inside of us. That we should be able to find that Nachash within us and put it out. Because that Nachash is there. It's the Yetzer Hara, it's selfishness, it's the desire for things that are really not so important. It's getting enchanted with things that are not at all important. And so this is part of the human challenge. And unfortunately, alcohol abuse is both something to turn to in order to avoid looking at and finding your own Nachash. And once you're involved with the alcohol, then you're convinced you don't need to look anymore. You don't need to follow. You don't need to go. Denial. It's all good. Even though nothing's good. The person who is truly happy and content for the right reason is least likely to begin abusing substances. What we need to do, therefore, is recognize this problem, and we need to increase our families' and schools' chances of creating and fomenting true Jewish fulfillment / happiness. And it cannot happen successfully in a family where, as we've said, there's a problem. There's a drinking problem in an adult. What does a child experience? 5-year-old, 7-year-old, 14-year-old, 18-year-old, what does that son or boy, what does that daughter or girl experience if the Shabbos table is with this fellow who's just not fully there anymore because he's had too many with his chaverim at the kiddushes? He comes home, and there's this lack of clear Shabbos Kodesh and lack of proper parenting. The greatest gift to a child is for the child to experience the love, the harmony, the shalom bayis of his or her parents, watching, consideration, and respect, because that gives the child a sense of security, a sense of well-being. That's a true home. That's protectiveness. And then love, it filters down. It filters down because it's so prevalent and the respect is so prevalent between mother and father, it will filter down. And the understanding of that as a goal in life will filter down. It's learned by association. It's witnessed by the son and daughter. But what if the parent is living just for himself or herself. So all that giving, and ahava means to have, here, give. If all of that giving that's missing leaves a vacuum, not only in the life of the adult, but now in the life of the child. And what they're learning is that the emphasis is on achievement, of more money, of buying more things, nicer things, fancier things, of getting, not keeping up with the Rosenbergs, getting way ahead of the Rosenbergs. So if that's what life is about, children learn that, that's what they see. If children could see that their parents' motivation is not how much pleasure can I get out of life? How much indulgence can I enjoy? That's not at all a theme in the life of a child. He or she sees that it's not at all in the life of their parents. We have a chance. Then we have a chance. They see a parent, they see their parents living for a purpose and not for pleasure. They can make a similar choice, just like the choice that their parents make. But look around us, and look at how much the pleasures of life mean to us in the Vroom community. I mean, I remember the first time there was the concept of a place that sells, you know, let's say sushi, for an example. Mm-hmm. So, all right, I don't know who needs it, I don't know what it tastes like. It actually is something I enjoy, but to have an emphasis on it, you have to have it. Imagine somebody today making a chasana, and they say, we'll have a simple buffet, we'll have three hot dishes at the smorgasbord. Impossible. Impossible. Let alone, you know, saying, I don't need sushi at the smorgasbord. Everything is extravagant. Everything is just limitless. And it has to be. The sense is that otherwise we're not doing what's right. We're not doing what's meaningful. It's not going to be beautiful. Asana will be missing something. It won't be missing anything. It has nothing to do with what the Simcha is all about. People talk about where we're vacationing. It's not just about finding a beautiful place to rest and to relax. But where? How exotic? And what kind of kosher restaurants are there? And how exclusive is it? I mean, you know, teachers in our schools locally here tell me that a child's parents are going intercession in the winter break. If they're going to Miami, the child is ashamed to say to the friends they're going to Miami because, you know, that's, you go to Miami, that's not a place to be. It has to be, you know, some really expensive and exotic, and we are emphasizing pleasures without showing and teaching that the purpose of life is not maximum fun and pleasure. And that's something that is to be corrected. It has to be corrected in the community, in the family. It has to be corrected in schools. Schools have to be careful about how exclusive they are and who they take in. And then in the classroom, what percentage of the room is the Rebbe or the Maura or the teacher really directing his or her efforts toward? Are they looking for 80, 90% success? Or do they say, look, I've got 20, 30% who are really getting it, who are great kids, and, you know, we're going to take them. What happens to the rest of them? Those who are not going to go with them to the highest heights of scholastic achievement. Oh well, Watts, what? They'll be where? How will they find happiness? What will make them feel good, achieved, worthy? The street, their buddies, there's a whole street full of kids waiting to receive those who are feeling, they're not really rejected, but they're feeling rejected. There's a street full of all the toxic, poisonous attitude. And the street is toxic. Absolutely poisonous. And there's a street full of kids waiting to receive them when they're unhappy and leave the classroom. So we have to look at that and look at the not just average, child, all of the children, how can we have them feel fulfilled, even if scholastically they're even perhaps way below average? How can we have them understand how important and meaningful they are as human beings, let alone as Jewish sons and daughters? And then for all of the children, the schools have to begin to understand that it's not just Torah knowledge that has to be taught, but it's deeper meaning and relevance. We can't just teach knowledge of Torah or even learning skills, but have people understand a hashkafa, a view of life that will cause a young person to know how she, he can make steps from the youngest age toward self-fulfillment, toward being a person who everybody will love, most importantly, he or she will love himself and herself. These are the attitudes and the ways of thinking that a person has to develop. For otherwise, as we said before, they will not have ability, they will not have the realization of how important it is to look inside, to do a cheshbon ha-nefesh, with love, with self-love, to do a self-assessment that's brutally honest, but very optimistic, and say, who am I, what am I, where is that nachash within me, where is my nachash, let me put it out of me, let me remove the nachash from within. What will I, what am I filling my life with that's meaningful, that I can depend upon, because that's going to ultimately mean that I will have a positive, glorious, purposeful day, and another day, and another day, a life that will be full of meaning, and therefore not have to worry of substances coming in to fill the gap, to fill the vacuum. Making oneself know and feel his or her own worth and value is the best hope for establishing a proper, upstanding, clean individual and society, a healthy self-concept, no unwarranted feelings of inferiority. Then we'll have a beautiful Shabbos, we'll have a beautiful Wochentags, each day meaningful, the Shabbos will be a spiritual height of life, the children will see it and feel it and learn it, and so much of that which is so challenging, as we've said, an increasingly tolerant world that's allowing for self-abuse, will not be as great a threat to the Jewish community and to the Jewish family as it seems to become in our time. Thank you. Happy to take questions.
So what can the schools do to make this problem go away of the child who is rejected, they don't know the Torah so well, and
each child has to be embraced and celebrated for his or her accomplishments, and that has to be without a bias, without clear, open bias in celebration of only the top 10, 5, 20%, whatever it might be. As much as we can, we have to reward those who are very, very high achievers. At the same time, we have to make sure to be very sensitive to and lift up and support and celebrate the significant achievement of the child who did the best he or she could.
So maybe there should not be marks.
Me?
Yeah.
How much of everything you just said is a commentary on parenting skills?
Much.
Let's take 100% of everything you just said from beginning to end. How much of what you just said is a commentary on parenting?
Parenting skills means how to apply a lot of what was just said, how to make it happen.
Do You think
the underlying, what I was trying to emphasize was the underlying way of life of the parent, how the parent then skillfully teaches, guides, parents the child, and that's obviously a huge responsibility.
And that's essentially over by 12, 13. By the time they're bar bat mitzvahs, you're mostly done.
It's over by 12 or 13 if you haven't succeeded in bringing your child to understand how much there's yet to learn and how much he or she should yet learn from the parent by parenting properly at age 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. If you haven't done the job successfully during 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, yes, then by the time 13, 14 comes, it's too late to begin.
I think it's simple to say that it's just the factors of culture. I've had the experience of being in a liquor store in Israel and watching Bachurim buying $100 bottles of wine and thinking to myself, I mean, where are they getting this money and why are they spending it on this? I don't think that these are necessarily Bachurim with emptiness, with I think the Rav made a very, you know, worthwhile point. But what about the cultural
Goes out and spends $200 on a bottle of Johnny Walker. What is it called? Blue Label.
Blue Label.
Because instead of the parent having a little L'chaim and saying L'chaim and not talking about it, you can have a Blue Label at your table.
My husband's not involved.
You can have. Let me finish. You can have Blue Label at the table. You can enjoy it. If there are people who enjoy it and they know it and they know the difference and they sense it and they enjoy it, you have one l'chaim after the fish, and you say, "Ah, l'chaim tov l'shalom." That's it. The difference is when you make a big deal out of it, when they have this whole discussion of where you got it, how, and which one is better, and you put primacy on it as if it's so important. That is why so if the parents are that way, the children are going to see. That's what's quote unquote chashuv. What's important is that we have these really exceptionally rare or expensive types of drink, these types of single malt, and it becomes, yes, culturally, it becomes important and it becomes a yetzer hara. The way to avoid that is to have children raised in homes where these things are unimportant, have no importance whatsoever. On the other hand, I have to tell you, I have seen kids, 50, 60 kids of a yeshiva class celebrating a bar mitzvah of a friend. And at the bar mitzvah, it's not just a table of liquor. It's a display table. It's a three-tiered display table of the most expensive and exotic 30-year scotch, you know, and it's everybody's crowding around it and oohing and aahing because, this is bar mitzvah. We used to joke and say it's bar, it's bar mitzvah. But children are watching this. What are they learning?
Too much bar.
What are they learning? All right.
So I am a buffer in the parsha who takes medications, and I cannot handle any alcohol. So my concern, on the day of my chasna, Meretz Hashem, how will people know not to give me the wrong thing to drink? Because I could, with 50 people around me during the Ketzad Meraktan, I would not be able to tell apart a glass of water from a glass of vodka.
You shouldn't be with people who would hand you a glass of vodka.
I went to Shiva Dar Yerushalayim.
I can only tell you that no one should hand someone else a glass of anything without saying, "Would you like a little?" Anybody who has a glass of vodka and hands you, anybody who could hand you a glass of vodka, is someone to, maybe say, "Let's invite someone else to the way." Have a good day, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.